Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. It's day 5 of the 2018 Tribeca Film Festival, a day that will wrap with 5 television series pilots going for public and possibly industry acceptance. At this festival, there's more TV than ever. Here live when filming director Carol Cusimano and TV creator Lisa Dimnitz join me next on site. Ever hear of cornhole? If not, you will, and see it soon on ESPN. In our second half hour, we'll connect with a twosome raising the sport's national profile, executive producer Greg Whitecamp and play-by-play caller Trey Ryder. Hallmark Hall of Fame returns to Hallmark Channel Saturday night with The Beach House. It's a love story of humans and creatures alike, and executive producer Dan Wigertow will explain next hour. Also ahead, a pair of TBS renewals, HBO promises a sharp object summer, and our new classic trivia question and prize. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, proud development partner of the New York Television Festival, and a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later this half hour. Happy Monday afternoon to you, and welcome once again to the program All About Television. We're delighted to have you with us. 67 degrees at the top of the hour, big night in edition coming your way, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. All you have to do is pick up the phone, raise your voice, and dial in at this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio. We also have our chat room in business. It's SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televisor. Use the phone or the room. Either way, we will get you involved. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen. Follow the instructions. Other people can be live with you. The key programmers of the Tribeca Film Festival will join us live from that scene after these news notes. TBS opened the week with a pair of series renewals. The Last OG, starring Tracy Morgan and Tiffany Haddish, will return for a second season. OG debuted a few weeks ago to bop-up attention from critics, and Bureau Reaction is the year's top-rated new cable TV comedy so far. The second renewal goes to Search Party, the thriller-style dramedy that will go to a third season. Search Party co-creators Sarah Violet Bliss and Charles Rogers will continue to be part of the series, and under a new arrangement, develop new projects for TBS and possibly sister networks TNT or True TV. Runaway limited series Sharp Objects will get its run on HBO going this July. Amy Adams stars in a murder mystery based on Gillian Flynn's bestseller. Flynn and Adams serve as executive producers, with Flynn scripting a number of episodes. She recently signed a multi-year series development with Amazon, kicking off with adapting the controversial British drama Utopia. Now some quickies. NBC, NBC Sports Network, and Olympic Channel reached a deal for 80-plus hours of figure skating coverage a year through 2026. It includes both the United States and the European Figure Skating Championships. Viola Davis' documentary series, The Last Defense, which will be getting a screening at the Tribeca Film Festival later this week, will premiere June 12th on ABC. And DreamWorks will bring The Fast and the Furious to animated series life via an extended and expanded relationship with Netflix. And that is news notes for today. And now joining us live from the Tribeca Film Festival in Lower Manhattan, here are the two key programmers behind the festival, Carol Cusimano and TV creator Lisa Dimnitz. Carol, Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Karen, we'll start with you. What's been going on with the festival so far as television is concerned?
We're very excited about our TV program this year. We have about 12 new and returning series premiering, all of which will be paired with in-depth conversations with the cast and the creators, which is such a great opportunity for TV fans. A few things have premiered already. We had Westworld and Genius Season 2, but still to come are the premieres of Cobra Kai, Bobby Kennedy for President, Drunk History, a lot more that's really exciting.
Liza, why, when there are so many festivals covering television exclusively, like New York and Series Fest in Denver and ITVF in Manchester, New Hampshire, why is Tribeca doing an expanded look at television in the first place?
Well, Tribeca's been doing TV as part of its festival almost since its inception.
I believe we had the finale of Friends that we, you know, we showed outdoors at our drive-in years ago. So we've always believed in the medium of television as an amazing one for storytelling. But about 3 years ago, we created in earnest the Tribeca TV section because, you know, the quality and the sort of onslaught of prestige TV became so huge, and the storytelling and the creators that were going to TV to make work were so excellent and so much definitely on par with the films that we include that are our bread and butter at the festival. So, you know, we wanted to bring people together to watch, you know, have sort of a once-in-a-lifetime experience in that they see a screening of an episode and they have the chance to stick around afterwards and meet the cast and a lot of the creative team behind the episode and ask them any and all questions that they might have. And it just becomes another way to bring people together to experience stories.
Kara, do you think that in time every film festival will do television to one extent or another? Sundance has been doing it also for several years. You're now doing it, and you also started last year a TV festival. We're going to get to that and where that stands later on in our conversation this half hour. But do you see, for example, the New York Film Festival doing it at some point, or Telluride doing it, or just about every film festival in the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the separation between what is a film and what is a TV show in the age of Netflix and Amazon is becoming increasingly blurry. And this is something that we've embraced, and we've created space at the festival for all of these new platforms from VR to television. And right now they all sort of exist separately, but we year after year increasingly see them fusing together and crossing over in new and interesting ways. So to me, the future of a festival is going to be more of a storytelling festival where these distinctions are not as important. So, I mean, I think there'll always be space for a very traditionalist look at cinema and preserving classic film culture on a big screen, and some festivals, you know, that's their mission. So I hope that continues to exist. But I also think you'll increasingly see TV kind of permeate into festival programs as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. Liza, when you put your side of the festival together, dealing with television, are there certain parameters that at the start you work with that you want to make sure you cover, whether it is documentaries or ways to showcase the classic television or TV that may be overlooked? And there's an example of that that you showcased yesterday that I want to get to in a little bit too, as well as the big premieres coming up, as well as the pilot season, where you give people an opportunity to showcase pilots that very well might become the TV series of tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, when we started doing the Tribeca TV section, it was primarily working with sort of the major networks, seeing what was coming down their pipeline in terms of their calendars and see if we can, you know, bring a premiere episode or perhaps a premiere series to the festival so that we could be the first ones to show it to the public. And as that grew to be more and more successful, we realized that we wanted to start including the indie pilots, the television that had been yet to be acquired, but hoped to be acquired by perhaps a major network. So we opened submissions to the festival for these indie pilots, and as a result, we created this program called Pilot Season. This is our second year, and we have five really diverse narrative pilots that we're going to actually be premiering this evening.
How many pilots were submitted for this, and what was the criteria for picking the five that are being shown tonight?
We had a couple of hundred submissions, and we're also the TV programmers are always keeping our eyes open and networking with our various filmmaker connections to see who might be making something. And the criteria was we're just looking for really interesting ideas, things that we could see develop further into a full series. You know, we have comedies. We have a really interesting sci-fi pilot called Tantalum. We even have a sort of a dark comedy from Israel called On the Spectrum. So it's really very similar to how we program our films. We're looking for interesting voices, new voices, diverse voices. And, you know, it's a really difficult process because we do see a lot of amazing work, but we feel super confident about these five pieces that we're showing this year.
Two of those five pilot makers, Naomi Coe from NICE and Clara Novis from Templin, were on our program this past week. And if you want to catch the episodes with them on it, you can go to our homepage, blogbookradio.com/televised, or go to the iHeartRadio Podcast Network at iHeartRadio.com. We're talking to Tribeca Film Festival, the TV side of things, with two key programmers of the festival involved with what's going on at various places in Lower Manhattan. We're talking about Tony director Tara Cusimano and TV creator Liza Dinnis. They're both with us live from the Big Apple this half hour. On Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Delighted you're with us as the Tribeca Film Festival continues into its first week, started this past Wednesday night. We'll continue through the end of the month. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a ring, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Our very good friend from Philadelphia, Rick Webb, just went into the room. Friday on Tomorrow Will Be Televised, we hope to have the creators of top network series, Hollywood Darlings, premiered last year, turned out to be one of the sleeper comedies of the year, and just came back last week for its second season. That's coming up Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Televised. And stay tuned, because later on this hour, we'll have our new classic trivia question of the week. If you're first with the correct answer, you will win the National Geographic DVD of their acclaimed documentary last year, Jane, with original score by Philip Glass. It's coming up later this hour. Kara, one interesting aspect this year of the festival is these documentaries that showcase shows past. And one last night that really caught my attention was a documentary called Mr. Soul. It is about soul, which was perhaps the public television answer to the Ed Sullivan Show. It ran 5 years. It was one of the first national programs produced by WNET Channel 13 here in New York. It was hosted by Ellis Hayslip, who also produced the show. And it really turned out to be a pivotal moment of black culture showcased on television.
Yeah, this is a really beautiful documentary about soul and the important work that it did in that moment in time. And it's been 50 years, so we were able to bring the show back to life for a moment for its 50th anniversary. After the premiere last night, we did a beautiful live performance that included music and dance and poetry and really paid homage to what that show was all about from the 1968 to 1973 when it existed. And I think it speaks to the TV program this year in a bigger sense, where we really take TV history and TV culture seriously. We have some amazing new premieres, but we also look backwards on these seminal moments, whether it is a Mr. Soul, whether it's Freaks and Geeks being so far ahead of its time, or new episodes of The Staircase, the seminal true crime series. There's a forward-looking and a backward-looking in the TV program this year that I think represents TV culture in a bigger way.
Well, when it comes to forward-looking, I would think that a lot of networks had to, come your way with ideas, showcase my program, showcase this program. For example, you had Westworld on this past Friday night. It's already gotten rave reviews for the second season. Later this week, you have Sweet Bitter, the brand one of two new half-hour shows on Starz, the premiere next month. How do you determine when you have so many people coming at you from all sorts of networks and services, from Starz to HBO to Netflix to CBS, how do you determine what does get presented?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we're looking to be able to program to a whole super wide variety of audience. And so, it's important to us to represent both the doc community and the narrative community, whether that be a drama or a comedy. So, for instance, having something like Sweet Bitter, which is based on, such a best-selling novel, we know there's a lot of interest, here in New York to see that takes place in New York. Obviously, we know Westworld is a huge epic hit. So if, we had the opportunity to program that, that was a, no-brainer. But also something, like Drunk History, that's a comedy. We can really eventize that screening. We can have people come. They can have a drink. They can laugh. It's very, again, very similar to how we program films. We are very conscious of the differing kinds of audience members that we have, and we want to make sure that we're speaking to each of them. With the indie pilot section, that's also really speaking to the filmmaker community themselves. This gives them an opportunity to be in front of a huge array of industry and potentially get their attention so that they can you know, who knows, maybe they can develop a relationship and there could be an acquisition in their future.
Mm-hmm. Kara, where do you see television at right now? We seem to be in three eras of television, an era of plentiful original scripted TV and unscripted too, an era of diverse TV, more diverse than ever before, on all sides of the camera, and also we're in the era of smart TV sets and smart devices, where more and more people are watching television through smart TV sets and likes of Samsung and Vizio and LG and Panasonic, as well as Apple TV, Google Chromecast, Amazon Fire TV, and so forth. And there's much more you can do now with that television than ever before, especially since many of these sets and all sets going forward and devices are going to have artificial intelligence, Siri, Alexa, and so forth, allow you to do everything from Google Assistant change the course of this show from this point to Alexa or an Uber ride.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an exciting time because there are so many innovators looking for what the next point of connection with the audience is going to be. Obviously, Netflix has been hugely successful, and that changed the way TV and films were made and consumed. And I think the audiences really just are looking for the best stories. They don't feel committed to a 90-minute feature film versus a 30-minute sitcom versus a one-hour drama. Those are starting to feel more and more old-fashioned. So I think that it creates a lot of opportunity for creators because they can make what they want to make. The thing can be the length that it needs to be to tell the story, and then it can live on the platform that's best suited for connecting that story with the audience. And we've certainly seen that flourishing in our programming process and have programmed the festival in a way to reflect it and to connect those stories even further.
Mm-hmm. Liza, something else that your festival does is showcase virtual reality and augmented reality, both through screenings and through panels. I'm curious from what you're getting. Are the virtual reality people and the augmented reality people realizing that perhaps TV may have to be the way to go, put it on the television set as opposed to put it in headgear, because so far it seems that the public is rejecting watching VR in a big way by headgear for all sorts of rationale.
That's interesting. You know, I'm not a VR programmer, but I will say that as what we have seen is sort of the intersection of TV and VR in this year's selections. There are a number of episodic projects within the VR arcade and our 360 theater. So I think that VR filmmakers are sort of embracing TV in their own way. And, you know, if people are able to come down to check out our VR exhibition here, it's truly mind-blowing. The exhibitions are incredible. And, I mean, I think, you know, these VR filmmakers are hoping that people will start to slowly embrace VR in a different way and perhaps, you know, creating episodic content is one way to hook people in because they'll see one thing and they'll be itching to see the next episode. I think the door is sort of open right now in terms of what is going to happen with the public embracing it. It's still early. We are just really excited to be able to show it off at the festival. It's just another cool thing for people to be able to experience while they're here.
By the way, 360 programming, which is VR programming to a lot of people, you can do it on smart TV sets and smart devices, and it looks really, really good. I've seen it done on Apple TV. There's a project called Little Star, which showcases VR content, and you take your Apple TV remote control and swipe the remote any which way you want, up, down, diagonally, and it works very, very well without a headset. And some people, that may be how they see VR.
Exactly.
And with artificial intelligence, I think that personally may be a big boon for both VR and for augmented reality getting on television, because that might be the way that perhaps interactive television, starting with AR, can finally happen. We are speaking with the key programmers at the Tribeca Film Festival and making TV happen there through the end of the month. We're talking about programming director Kara Cusimano, TV creator Liza Dinnis. They're both with us live from the Big Apple this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Apple now with you live from the Big Apple as well. 67 beautiful degrees outside here in the New York metro area. Delighted you're with us, whether you're catching us on Blog Talk Radio or the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you have a question or comment for our guests, they're with us for a few more minutes, so make the phone happen, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Live in the last year, on quite short notice, Tribeca launched a TV festival. How did it go? Is it coming back this year?
It is indeed coming back, yes. We don't have exact dates yet, but it'll be September 2018. This was something that we created after the great success of the Tribeca TV section during the regular Tribeca Film Festival. And essentially what we did is we took the model of what we do here at the festival, which is a premiere screening, whether that be of a brand new series or returning series or just a world premiere of an episode. And we bring the cast and the creative team behind the episode to the event, and they do a moderated conversation afterwards and gives the audience a chance to get inside the series and ask questions. So essentially, we did that over that same model over a long weekend in September at one of our main Tribeca Film Festival venues in Chelsea. And we had a jam-packed 3 days of screenings and discussions, and it was really quite amazing. We had a sneak peek of the new Will and Grace series. We had Oprah with her docu-series called Released, and a whole bunch of other things like Gotham and, even some digital series from the online network. So we will be doing it again. We're really excited. We are already, knee-deep in programming for it, so information will be coming out about with details very soon.
Do you have a sense about how you want to expand the festival, let's say, do some things that you didn't do before the first time around, you can do the second time around with an expanded schedule? Also, I was wondering whether, in addition to maybe expanding the pilot season, maybe offer more pilots, the opportunity for more discussion of trying to get new TV series funded, either through venture capitalists, through angel investors, or through the new process of blockchain and cryptocurrency?
Yeah, well, one thing that we haven't mentioned that's another really important section of the festival is Tribeca New Online Work, otherwise known as Tribeca Now. This is a section that we started 5 years ago to embrace the wave of really amazing content that was coming from the online space. So every year we bring to the festival between 10 and 12 creators who are making work specifically for the online space. They come, they premiere a piece of work, whether that be an episodic narrative series, a docu-series, a short form film, animation, what have you. It's really broad. And we bring them to the festival, they premiere their work at public screenings, and we also put a lot of their work up online after it's premiered. And so this is just another arm of storytelling that is really exciting for us. Our first year, 5 years ago, of Tribeca Now, we had the very well-known series High Maintenance before it was on HBO and it was still a digital series. And we've worked with a lot of really other interesting creators who have gone on to do pretty amazing projects. So that's another way of embracing filmmakers who are yet to be acquired, by major networks. That is, this coming to the festival and exhibiting their work under the umbrella of Tribeca gives them a huge opportunity to be seen not only by a public audience, but also an industry audience, and open some doors. In an additional part of that Tribeca Now section, we have something called the Tribeca Now Creators Market, and this is a day-long industry event where essentially we allow the Tribeca Now creators to pitch a project and to a huge group of industry, and who knows, maybe get their next job, maybe get their job, maybe get their series that they've brought to the festival acquired. So again, this is an opportunity for new work to be seen and to hopefully go on to live a fruitful life online or on regular network TV.
Are there any plans to do a similar project or a similar event for the TV festival?
For the TV festival?
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's a possibility. We want to continue taking submissions and exhibiting these indie pilots. They get opportunities throughout the festival to meet industry. And so We have seen some really interesting collaborations happen after people have just met people at events and collaborated on their next project.
Mm-hmm. Karen, before we go, do you see as things progress and as we see more people get into television, like Apple, like the Disney proposed family-friendly Netflix-like service, like Facebook Watch, which is now really starting to make scripted television happen, and Vimeo still doing what it's doing, and of course Hulu, Amazon, Crackle, who we'll hear from with their new projects tomorrow here in New York at their parent company Sony's building. Do you see the possibility of Tribeca working with other film festivals to do collaborations when it comes to showcasing television, whether it is showcasing new series that already have a place or showcasing pilots?
I think how we showcase TV moving forward, it will evolve in parallel with all of these new platforms and new opportunities. We always want the festival to feel like it mirrors the visual storytelling culture at large, which is why it has the sections it does and looks the way it does right now. So, you know, potentially some kind of collaboration in the future could feel like the right thing. I think we always come at it from the point of view of curators, and this explosion of opportunities and platforms and content is really exciting for us, and a place that we can really add value to the experience for the viewers by saying, we've seen everything, here's what we think are the best new programs, new projects that you should really look out for. And I think a lot of other festivals feel that way as well. So I think there's also value to every festival having its own identity, its own point of view, and that way you as the viewer know what to expect when you come to each curated selection.
Mm-hmm. Tonight, pilot season, the second round of the annual Tribeca Film Festival will be happening tonight. It takes place, by the way, at the Cinépolis Chelsea Cinema. It's over on 23rd Street, right off 8th Avenue. And by the way, right here, there's the School Visual Arts Theater, another one of the places where Tribeca will be doing its thing now till the end of the month. If you want more details about the entire Tribeca Film Festival schedule, TV included, here's where you go online, www.tribecafilm.com or tribecafilmfestival.com. It's www.tribecafilm.com and tribecafilmfestival.com. It's starting tomorrow night. One of the shows being screened is Cobra Kai. It's the brand new Karate Kid spinoff with the original people from that series of films, Ralph Macchio and William Zabka. And that will be running starting in May on YouTube Red. And we're going to try to get the creators of the show on our program sometime next month. Karen Casamano, thank you very much for taking the time from a very busy festival you've got. Congratulations on the new effort to make television happen. Hopefully it keeps expanding. We will be very excited about covering. We're going to be at pilot season tonight, and hopefully we will also be at the second annual Tribeca TV Festival in September. It's been a delight and a pleasure to have you both with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank
See you
there.
All right, you got it. Take care. Enjoy. Karen Casamano and Lisa Dimnitz joining us live from the Tribeca Film Festival here in New York. We'll have more tomorrow to be televised coming your way, but first some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. We told you earlier that Gillian Flynn's book Sharp Objects is being made into a limited HBO miniseries with Amy Adams heading the cast. Well, something else that Gillian Flynn is known for is the novel and former movie Gone Girl. Well, you can catch that now if you like, by way of audiobook through a trial run with Audible.com. It's narrated by Julia Whalen, and here's how you get it. You just go to this website and sign in. It's audibletrial.com/televised. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. There's over 100,000 titles to choose from. Don't forget, you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio. All you have to do is sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. It's so simple. You get one free audiobook of your choice, 1 month trial of the service, and great customer service because Audible is owned by none other than Amazon.com. So hear for yourself why Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world. And don't forget, they're also a proud development partner of the annual New York Television Festival coming your way this summer. Audibletrial.com/televised. Make it happen and find out why listening is the new reading at audible.com. When we come back, we will have two people responsible for bringing a new sport to national prominence. That sport is cornhole. We will have the executive producer of ESPN's upcoming coverage of the American Cornhole League, Greg Weinkamp, and play-by-play caller Trey Ryder. They will join us live from Indianapolis and Augustus, North Augustus, South Carolina, respectively. We'll get to them after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected with the best internet radio in the galaxy, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. It's your home for the Key to the Unplugged show. Check out this mix of music, madness, and all sorts of fun talk, too. The Key to the Unplugged show tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, that's featured and available to you 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the Marvy Televised 90-minute edition on this April afternoon of 2018. Simon Appel will be live from the Big Apple, where it's 76 degrees at the top, 67 degrees at the top of the hour. More great guests coming your way in the hour ahead to just join us, and we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes is a ring from you. So dial in at 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, already in the room. Have you heard of cornhole? That's right, cornhole. Well, cornhole is a sport that is popular around the country, and very soon ESPN is going to give it national attention through the activities of the American Cornhole League. You might be surprised how big this league is. In fact, it's so big it sort of runs like the NCAA, with conferences all over the country. Joining us live from Indianapolis, Indiana, the home of the Indy 500, is the executive producer of ESPN's upcoming coverage, Greg Weinkamp. Hi, Greg.
How you doing?
Very, very well, thank you. And also joining us live from North Augusta, South Carolina, the person who will be handling the play-by-play duties for Greg's coverage, Trey Ryder. Trey, good to have you aboard.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It is a pleasure and well appreciated. Greg, for a lot of folks who may be listening and don't know, what is cornhole and how long has it been a sport?
Well, I don't have the actual history of it. Trey may be able to provide a little bit better answer in terms of the origination and where it came from. But what I can tell you is that it is a sport that has been growing over the last 10 years. It is very popular in the tailgating world, at colleges and universities across the country, especially on football Saturdays, leagues that are set up around cities and just local establishments have popped up over the last 5 years. And the ACL has done a great job of trying to pull it all together and bring the sport national prominence. And as you alluded to, we've been able to elevate that to national coverage on ESPN, and we'll have our fourth national broadcast coming up in May.
So, Trey, how does cornhole work? It's, when I first read about this, it sounded like horseshoes, or it sounded like darts, which is one of the most popular sports in England.
Yeah, so a lot of our players actually started as horseshoe players. We got a lot of carryover from that, as well as bowling. We do have a lot of bowlers that kind of turn to cornhole. But it's that game that you've seen walking through a tailgate, either at a football game, a concert, whatever it may be. The boards set so far apart, and you have bean bags. A lot of times they're filled with corn, or in the American Cornhole League, filled with a plastic resin. And you're playing against a team and just trying to throw more bags into the hole than your opponent, and you're on points for however many you throw in the hole, however many land on the board. And so what started as just a tailgate game, you know, 20 years ago has slowly evolved over, especially the past 15 years, into a competitive sport, tournaments popping up with cash prizes, people starting to get better, more competitive, and the more they play, the more money they want to win, the bigger the tournaments get. And we've been fortunate enough to work with Greg and get some national broadcast time with these big tournaments over the past year and a half, and we're looking forward to more of them.
Is this Trey, is this played as an individual sport, or is it played as a team sport? And how did you get involved in becoming sort of like the play-by-play voice of this pastime?
Yeah, so we actually offer both singles and doubles divisions through the league. And for this upcoming broadcast in Green Bay, this week, this upcoming weekend, May 4th through 6th. We'll be featuring our doubles team squaring off against each other. It brings a little bit more intensity to the table. A lot of these players used to be former athletes, so they have that team sport mentality, so they tend to like doubles a little bit more on the broadcast side. But I got involved really as a player. I started playing competitive cornhole about 9 years ago. Started going to these big tournaments, like I said before, getting really into it. And then in 2015, the American Cornhole League was founded and started to grow a little bit. And my dad, who's actually a player as well, my dad, Eric Ryder, got involved with Stacy Moore, our commissioner, started to do things behind the scenes. And when the time came around that they were looking for somebody to step in and do a little commentary on the sport, me having a little bit of a technical background, I was like, you know, I can combine this of both worlds, the cornhole that I love and my, you know, logistical, technical mind. I was like, oh, I'll take a stab at it. And I worked at it and kind of got to know the sport on a different level and auditioned for this role as an analyst for the American Cornhole League. And they liked me enough to bring me on board, and I've been doing it ever since.
Greg, we've seen in the last 2 years or so a couple of sports sort of come to prominence. There's the E-League, you know, eSports, where you see people playing video games and you try to see how they do well at the games. But there's also been drone racing, which ESPN has been one of the pioneers in terms of covering. I have to say the coverage that they've done of the Drone Racing League is quite remarkable. When you take on the assignment of bringing a relatively new sport for people around the country to life, and you want to showcase as best as possible, what goes in your mind as an executive producer? How do you determine what elements of the sport are important to cover, and how do you give people a really good flavor of what they're going to see?
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to do is when you have not seen a sport, you've got to educate the viewers. You have to assume first and foremost, that the people tuning in, when you hit a national distribution on ESPN or ESPN2, that you are going to stumble across casual viewers that are looking to go to ESPN and they stumble across it. So you have to take advantage of that. And in today's world where people are not watching, sitting down and watching for hours upon hours, you've got to really hit immediately with the audience, meaning you've got about 15 minutes to try to educate them about the sport and try to show them the excitement of the sport. And so every time that we're thinking about a new sport like this, those are the things that are going to your head, is that you're going to get new viewers and you need to educate them and show them the excitement of the sport immediately. And that can be very difficult to do, because when you're sitting in a production truck and you are showing a 2, 3, or 4 hour production, depending upon what it is, you have to constantly remind yourself, even though you may have just said that 20 minutes ago, or you may have gone through the rules of the game, or you may have done a feature on techniques for throwing bags, whatever the case may be, you have to understand that 20 minutes ago, you may not have had that same viewer. So it doesn't hurt to go through all that again. So we have just been doing this. The first broadcast was back in July. And I said fourth early on. This will actually be our fifth coming up in May. And we're still taking that same approach, in part because these broadcasts are spread out. We were on first in July, then we had an event in December, then one in January, then March, now May, and then we'll be on again in July. So you're not seeing it weekly, so you have to make that assumption that you're getting new audiences every time, and you have to take full advantage of that every time.
How many hours is each of these events covered on ESPN, and what time are they running?
So they're broken down into two. They're broken into basically it's 2 days worth of coverage on the event. The first day is on ESPN3, and so if you're specifically talking about the upcoming event in Green Bay, which is Friday, May 4th, it will be from 7 Eastern to approximately 11. Now, the beauty about ESPN3 is you don't have the broadcast window, so if you go past 11 o'clock, so be it. I think our last coverage in Las Vegas was supposed to be 4 hours, and we ended up going 5 hours because the matches were longer, and it just took longer to get through the entire schedule for that evening. On Saturday, it's broken down into a two-hour production that's live on ESPN3 and then is re-aired on ESPN2 on Sunday at 8 o'clock. And on Saturday, where we have developed into is, as Trey says, featuring the final matches of the doubles tournament and then a couple of other championship matches as well. So within a two-hour production, you're going to see five or six matches within that broadcast window.
Is ESPN providing its own camera crew, or is there an outside production company that's responsible for the coverage?
Well, we are the outside production company. The company that I work with is called Tupelo Raycom, and we have been secured by the ACL to produce and package this event on their behalf. So the ACL is providing the production levels for ESPN, and we are hiring and bringing in the camera operators and the crew from various locations. For the most part, the main portion within the truck, our producer, our director, those are on our full-time staff, and we try to keep those positions as consistently as possible. Your camera operators generally are more localized to the region that you're in.
We're talking about the American Cornhole League. It's one of the newest sports that's being presented on ESPN. The coverage actually started last July, but now it is picking up with an event coming up in May and another one in July. First day's coverage is on ESPN3, which is, I believe, available on some smart TV sets and some smart devices, and certainly through your mobile app. The second day is also carried in replay on ESPN2. Joining us live from Indianapolis is the executive producer of the coverage, Greg Whitecamp, and from North Augusta, South Carolina, the play-by-play caller, Trey Ryder. They're both with us live this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Applebaum along with you for the ride. Happy with us on Sunday afternoon live from Nueva York. And if you have a question or comment for our guest, don't be shy and make the move. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up in our next half hour, we will have the executive producer of a new Hallmark Channel movie. It's the latest Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation. It's called The Beach House. Andy McDowell is the star, and Roger Spotswood, the director of such hit films as Under Fire, and great TV work like HBO's classic AIDS drama And the Band Played On, is the director. Dan Wigato is the executive producer. We'll be talking to him live from Los Angeles at the top of the hour. Trey, how do you do play-by-play for a sport like this?
Well, you know, Greg alluded to it a little bit earlier, but the first thing you really got to develop is an education for the sport. You really have to know it inside and out. And I've had the opportunity and been fortunate enough to have, like, grown up in this sport. It's something that, you know, I've played once a week for the past however many years. And when people ask me that, a lot of times I say, well, it's as if you took a professional announcer for football and you put them on planet Mars where they've never played football before. And, you know, he really has to change from talking about the intricacies and the details of the game down to a real basic level. You're talking to an audience, like Greg said, that doesn't really know anything about the sport. So it's a lot of focus on basics. It's a lot of focus on, you know, how the viewer at home can get engaged and how they can relate to whoever's on the screen. And then you throw in little details here and there just to spice it up and to get their interest piqued so that they have an interest in wanting to get better or wanting to learn how people have gotten to the level where they are now.
Incidentally, how is cornhole scored? Is it first team or first player to get to so many points wins, or is it done like, you know, like basketball or baseball? They're like innings, and at the end of a group of innings or four quarters, the team that's ahead, the duo that's ahead, the person that's ahead wins.
So when we do one, we'll have a round where you'll be throwing against an opponent, and each player throws four bags, and you will alternate throws. So in one round, however many bags that are landed on the board, you'll get 1 point for every bag on the board. For every bag that's in the hole, you get 3 points. But then we utilize cancellation scoring. So if I score 8 points and Greg scores 6 points, then I'll get 2 points towards my overall score. And then you play to 21 or over. You don't have to win by two. You don't have to hit 21 exactly. So you just play to 21 or over.
Trey, is the board like a bullseye board where, you know, you have circles around the hole is in the center, circles around, and how much you score depends on, as you said, either putting the pack in the hole or landing at a certain or hitting it a certain part of the board?
So our boards are 2 foot wide by 4 foot long, and the front of the board sits about 3 inches from the ground, and the back of the board sits about 12 to 13 inches from the ground, so it is on a slant. The hole is a 6-inch hole, and it sits 9 inches from the back of the board. So it doesn't have any bullseye rings or anything like that. Anywhere landing on the board, as long as it doesn't jump on the board, you can't skip it across the ground, as long as it lands clean on the board, it's 1 point no matter which section of the board it's in. And as long as it falls in the hole, whether you throw it in the hole or your opponent pushes it into the hole, any bag in the hole at the end of the round will get 3 points.
Mm-hmm. Trey, the sportscaster, do you have any role models that you fashion your play-by-play after?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know if I necessarily have any role models as far as a style goes or anything like that, but I'm lucky enough to, my uncle has worked for ESPN for a number of years as a producer as well, and talking with Greg, and I've gotten some advice from them, and, you know, just coming into this role, being relatively new to the sportscaster role in general, my background being mostly in cornhole, a lot of my knowledge and everything is very raw as far as talent and as far as just speaking about a sport to a national broadcast viewership. I really had to kind of fine-tune some of my sayings and the way I talk about the sport, and have to really, you know, bring it down to basics. That's been something I've really tried to do. So a lot of the football broadcasters, I watch a lot of football, so guys like Troy Aikman I've watched a lot of, and obviously John Gruden has been one that I've watched a lot on ESPN, especially Monday Night Football. He's someone that I like his style as well. So, you know, I've gotten a little bit of tidbits from a lot of different sportscasters, but I try to develop my own style at the same time.
Greg, does Trey work as both play-by-play and commentator, or do you have a commentator partner with him?
Trey is our analyst. Ryan Alicio is our play-by-play person. Ryan Alicio. And they've done every event that we've done together, and so we're kind of growing as a team together. Our producer is David Harris, and the three of them combined have, like I said, done all 5 of the events that we've done on broadcast, and we'll continue to work together. So it's really good in terms of creating that consistency and chemistry amongst producer and talent to be able to carry that through from event to event to event, because they start to be able to read each other. They start to be able to understand what's coming next, and they understand each other's styles. And each broadcast then gets a little bit smoother. It can be a bit of a challenge when you are working with new people to the start, but the more comfortable, like anything else, the more comfortable you get with people, the better it is.
Is there a sideline reporter that goes like in between the players, the teams, that keep us posted, like what the strategy is, what the action is, what they're thinking along the sideline?
Yeah, we have a sideline reporter that we use mostly for interviews. More than anything, to get their immediate reaction after the matches. These guys and gals, I should say, are very emotional when it comes to the game. And capturing the raw emotion after the victory is really fun to do, especially on the double side. I think Trey would agree with this, that when you get teammates together, anytime you put teammates together and you're in a competitive situation and you're down into the semifinals, the championship, raw emotion sometimes takes over. That's mostly good. Sometimes it can be bad, of course, as well. But at the end of the day, we do have a sideline person, I guess you'd call it sideline, but they are roaming the court. It's a small area, but they're gathering interviews. She's gathering interviews and going from there.
Trey, is this a sport where men and women can play against each other, or is it men versus men, women versus women?
One thing that we love about the American Cornhole League is, and the sport of cornhole in general, is we really try to advertise it a completely gender-neutral sport. So we have men and women both competing in our open our advanced singles division, our advanced doubles division. We have mixing and matching of when men and women as partners, and our top female players are not just top female players, they're top players, and they perform really well. One of the best female competitors, Christine Packey, I think she finished ninth at our last event out of over 300 players. So it just goes to show you that it's not just men that dominate this sport or even are the best at this sport. It's a really equal playing field. Our male presence is definitely higher, our demographic-wise. We have a lot more male players, but we're slowly growing a female player base, and we're trying to get more and more females playing the sport.
We're talking about ESPN's coverage of the American Cornhole League, which will continue with an event next month and another one 2 months later. We've got the executive producer, Greg Whitecap, and play-by-player and commentator, Trey Ryder. Trey's joining us live from North Augusta, South Carolina. Greg from Indianapolis, both with us live this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. I have a few more minutes with them, so give us a ring if you can, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, Simon Apple Joe, for my name, and stay where you are, because coming up right after our interview, we will have our Clappers Trivia Question of the Week. If you're first with the correct answer to the question that we posed this week, you will win the National Graphic DVD of Jane, the acclaimed documentary from last year by Brett Morgan, with original music by none other than Philip Glass. Greg, where do you see this league going in the time ahead? Do you think we're going to see a pro league happen where you will have, let's say, the New York team, the L.A. team, the Chicago team, the Atlanta team, and so on?
Well, I would probably defer to Stacey Moore on that question in terms of how they would set up leagues. What I can tell you is that I certainly see the growth. I mean, when you get involved in something like this, I was a very casual player. Again, to Trey's point, whether it be at a college football game, you play casually in your backyard, whatever the case may be with your friends, with your family, either way. But what I've noticed is just in getting involved with the ACL, how many people are playing, whether it turns into teams where there's professional teams and there's cities with names. I don't know if it will ever get to that. I would think it would be more on the lines of a poker type where it's a very individualistic driven sport. Obviously you have teams when it comes down to doubles, but is there the potential that you could end up with a team, so to speak? Sure. Absolutely. But at the end of the day, I think right now it's continuing to get the word out about the sport, and the sport is individualized with partners at this point, and I think that's where the focus will be, at least for the immediate future. Where it goes beyond that, I would defer to Stacey on that one.
Stacey is, I guess, the head of the league.
That is correct. Stacey Moore is the commissioner of the league, and helps is really running this whole thing from soup to nuts.
Final question: is there a presenting sponsor or the possibility of one? And secondly, given that ESPN jumps across ESPN Plus, which is their new streaming direct-to-consumer service involving more expanded coverage of all sports on your smart TV set or smart device, is there a possibility for expanded coverage through ESPN Plus?
The answer is both yes. Johnsonville is the presenting sponsor for all of the events that we've been doing. You will see them heavily integrated in our July 4th event. The great thing about the July 4th event is that it's going to be on Coney Island. It is right next to the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. The Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest will be first, and then our broadcast will be right after. It's almost a doubleheader on July 4th. And then Johnsonville is very involved in that event. They've been a great sponsor for the league, and they activate around all of the events. The event in May is at their headquarters in Green Bay. So Johnsonville is a integral part to what the ACL is doing. In terms of the second part of that question related to ESPN Plus. Yes, I believe ESPN certainly has interest in expanded coverage. I think ESPN, it's not I think, they will take as much cornhole as we're willing to provide. Clearly, there's things that are taken into consideration within that around the events and how much we want to actually put out there. But yes, absolutely. I think between ESPN Plus, we will see perhaps some added events down the road, but there's certainly an appetite from ESPN to broadcast this sport both on their linear and digital platforms.
ESPN's coverage of the American Cornhole League will continue next month and July with separate events from different parts of the country. Executive produced by Greg Weitkamp and with Trey Ryder as their commentator. And to check your local listings for where to be running, it will either be on ESPN3, which I believe is available on some smart TV sets and smart devices, and also replays on ESPN2. So check your local cable system for where ESPN2 plays in your area, also on satellite as well. For more details about the programming online, you can go to ESPN.go.com. If you want more details about the league itself, here's where you go, www.iplaycornhole.com. That's exactly how it says, www.iplaycornhole.com. I have a hunch you're going to be seeing a lot more of this sport in the days and months to come. Greg Weitkamp, executive producer, trade writer, commentator, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on this half hour. Good luck with your upcoming events, and hopefully more and more folks will make this a big national pastime.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks so
You're
much.
You're welcome, Greg and Trey. You got it. Take care. Greg Weitkamp, executive producer of ESPN coverage of the American Cornhole League, joining us live from Indianapolis. Trey Ryder joining us live from North Augustus, South Carolina. And now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. And as we've been telling you all show long, if you're first with the correct answer, you will win the National Geographic DVD of their acclaimed documentary from last year, Jane by Brett Morgan, with the Jane Goodall, the famous animal scientist, with the original score by Philip Glass. Over the course of his career, Mickey Rooney did a number of television series. His first one was in 1954. Name it. What was Mickey Rooney's first television series? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget, when you email, include your name and your full mailing address. And who knows, you might be our second weekly winner in a row after Mason Radcliffe of North Dakota, who got the big answer last week. And he got three prizes as a result. Once again, if you're first with the correct answer, you will win the National Geographic Jane DVD with original music by none other than Philip Glass. Again, simonapple04@yahoo.com. If you just missed the question a moment ago, don't worry, I'll post it tomorrow morning on Facebook and on Twitter at my hashtag at UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, in order to win, guess what? You got to be in, so do so, and all the very best. This is Tomorrow We Televise, the program all about television. Now it's 11th year on the air. We're with you live Mondays and Fridays, sometimes Wednesdays as well, at 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you came in late on today's program, you want to catch up on episodes you missed, make it so easy for you. Just go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televise. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/televise. Or check out the podcast version. It's available in several ways, iTunes.com, Apple TV's iTunes podcast app, and on iHeartRadio.com. Just go to that website, put Tomorrow We Televise in the search bar, and you're there. And remember, if you don't have Apple TV, go to an Apple store near you anytime you like, or order it online. And remember, we love hearing from you. So email us at simonapple04@yahoo.com. You go through that email, as we mentioned a moment ago, to get involved in our class trivia question of the week. Let us know what you think about the program. Give us any suggestions for guests and topics. And you can also be part of a feature we do regularly called The Show to Know. Is there a TV show you like that doesn't get enough attention? Well, we want to give it that attention, but we've got to hear from you. And if we do, you will get your suggestion and your name on the air. So simonapple04@yahoo.com, and you can also find me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter. When we come back, Andy McDowell stars in the latest Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation. It's a very unusual love story. It's called The Beach House, and we will have the executive producer, Dan Guido, joining us live from L.A. after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. You are connected to the best internet radio around, www.blogtalkradio.com. More than 25 million listeners around the world every month. and growing. It's your home for a very unusual show called The Hope Collection. You can catch it every weekday at noon, that's Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific. The Hope Collection, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to Are We Televised on this April Monday of 2018, and welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Simon Appelbaum with you live from New York. 67 wonderful degrees at the top of the hour. It looks like it's going to be a fantastic week here in New York. Tribeca Film Festival going on as we speak. We had the programs from the festival with us earlier, and we have another great guest coming your way in the half hour ahead. So we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes, a call from you, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget our chat room. If that's the way you want to go to communicate, please do so. It's at blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's our homepage. Simon Apple 04 is the chat room. And Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, is already in the room. This coming Saturday night, Hallmark Channel presents its latest edition of the Hallmark Hall of Fame, one of the longest-running programs on television. It's an original film getting its world premiere called The Beach House, and it's a very unusual love story involving both human beings and the animals they come in contact with. The director is Roger Spottswood, whose great films include Under Fire. He was also director of one of my favorite TV movies of all time, the critically acclaimed HBO sensation And the Band Played On, one of the first TV movies or programs of any kind dealing with AIDS, executive produced by none other than Aaron Spelling. Joining us live from Los Angeles, one of the executive producers of The Beach House, Dan Wigertow. Dan, thanks for joining in.
Ah, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Tell me about this film and how it got made.
Well, that's always a good question, how films get made. This one was a story based on a book by Mary Alice Munro called The Beach House, and Annie McDowell and I had been working together on a series for Hallmark called Cedar Cove for 3 years, and I forget, 36, 37 hours. And she said, Dan, there's this book I love, and would you be willing to take a look at it and produce it? And I looked at it, and short story is, I decided, wow, that's something really strong and good and quite unusual, and let's see if we can do it. And cut to the chase, and here we are, you know, 9 months, a year later, and it's being broadcast on Saturday night.
As part of the Hallmark Hall of Fame. By the way, we had the author of the books of Cedar Cove. Congratulations on that 3-year run with Andy. It was a terrific, it was a big groundbreaker for Hallmark. It was the first scripted series. It did very, very well. A lot of people still remember it fondly. And like this, it seems that Hallmark does its best work when it adapts books, don't you think?
I do. I think, you know, I've done stuff for them that has not been from a book, but I'd say 90% of what I've done is all comes from, you know, pretty thoughtful and thought-provoking books. And this is what The Beach House is. And it's unusual for Hallmark, at least this particular story, but it is Hall of Fame, so it presents a different kind of story, characters, etc. And I love what Andy did in it as playing the mother. And, you know, she literally turned 60 within the last few days. And she looks great, sounds great, and is off in London the last we spoke doing another project.
Hmm. Talk about this film, because it is a movie that, as I mentioned at the top, is really a love story in two ways. It's a love story involving human beings, but it's also a love story about creatures from the sea, and how both love stories intertwine.
Yes, well, I think that's a really interesting, unique way of putting it, but yes, very much so. Loggerhead turtles, which are, you know, a major, the largest hard-shell turtle in the world, I believe. I may be off on that, but they are phenomenal, and they're all over the place. And what's amazing about it is that the characters in the story, as Andy in real life, are trying to do everything they can to help protect them. And I've been learning more and more about them and the fact that they managed to disappear. I mean, once the hatchlings go out to sea, they come back to literally the same beach that they left, say, 2 or 3 years ago. And they may travel as far as European, Mediterranean waters, et cetera, but they come back to South Carolina, Georgia, wherever it was that they were first hatched. And it's about protecting them from people, from the environment, from whatever possible to keep them keep them alive and well. So, yes, in a sense, that is a love story. And then the other love story, and actually there are even two more. It's a mother-daughter story in terms of how they reconnect, and then a story about a daughter who has disappeared and comes back and falls in love again with the guy that she left 10, 12, 15 years ago. So there are multiple love stories there, although, you know, there is a, if you will, a sadder side to it all as well, because the mother, is, it turns out she is dying of cancer. And that's what, you know, the daughter discovers when she returns to her home in the South.
When you have a story that has multiple dynamics, multiple family dynamics, dynamic of family and environment and interpersonal relationships, how do you balance the overall story out in the way the film
that's
is
a very, yeah, that's a very good question. And I think balance is extremely important because, I mean, I'll give it in a nutshell. The story is a daughter who has been raised in a typical Southern family. And because the father was bully, maybe too strong a word, but domineering, she left home and went off to Chicago in this case and developed her own life and own career. And she doesn't really connect much with her family and she comes back. So that is kind of the, you know, the heart of the story in many ways. And when she comes back, we have to balance what happens between mother and daughter when the daughter finds out her mother is dying of cancer, and between the daughter and the boyfriend she used to have, who was, he was engaged and that didn't work. She was with someone and that didn't work, and they come back together. So in a sense, it's two love stories, but set three love stories if we had the turtles. And sorry, I forgot that. You know, and it's all about how to balance those out and make each one of them connect to the other. And that has to do with the writer, with the director. I mean, you mentioned Roger Spotswood, who's done some phenomenal films. I had worked with him, actually, it turned out, in 1980, 81 on my second film, my career, and we reconnected. And you're right, the band played on. He's done James Bond. He's done Turner and Hooch. He's done all sorts of things. So I thought it was a real coup to get him back involved in doing a Hallmark Hall of Fame film. And the balance is continual.
I had a chance earlier before doing the show today to look up on Wikipedia Roger's filmography, and I believe this is his first TV movie in at least a decade. And I remember going to Atlanta to see the premiere of And the Band Played On. And I can tell that audience was incredibly moved. They had no idea what was going to hit them. And for those 3 hours, it was a roller coaster of all sorts of attitudes, all sorts of emotions, all sorts of dynamics. But the bottom line, I thought it was an incredible film for HBO to put on and for Roger to do and Aaron Spelling to produce. It was beautifully done, incredible performances. I still remember Ian McKellen's performance. It's one of the best things I think he ever did. To get this person back to doing television, like you said, it's a great, great coup. And it seemed like this was a film that was right up his bailiwick.
Well, you know, that's yes. I mean, I think in terms of the way it's done, you know, to talk about In the Band Played On, yeah, I mean, they're totally different stories in every possible way, but they're a good direction and good direction. And this is what he was able to do, is take a story of a whole different nature and make it work in a very thoughtful, smart, I'm obviously not objective here, but in a very thoughtful, smart and way that would involve an audience in these other people's lives and connect them to our main characters and what each one is going through. And I think that that's what Roger has been great at. I mean, even going back to Turner and Hooch, if you go back to that, I mean, that's a feature, yes, but Tom Hanks back when, but, you know, he's done some pretty terrific stuff. And as again, I feel very lucky that we were able to get him to do this. He's worked with animals before, by the way. He did a film that not many people in the United States knew about. It was really a London story called A Street Cat Named Bob. and it was about a literal street cat who helped rescue a drug addict. And before that, he did a polar bear story about a baby polar bear. So, you know, animals are not totally new to him. And he just, you know, we work with it. We don't have control over turtles totally, and we had to, you know, do some special effects to make that work. But we had a lot of help from the Georgia Department of Natural Resources and their turtle people and local people in where we filmed who just thought how important it was, starting with Andy McDowell, who thought, you know, the lives of turtles are so important. We need to protect them. And I think that's what we tried to do in the film or demonstrate in the film. And, you know, I hope we pulled it off.
The Beach House premieres this Saturday night as one of the latest presentation of the Hallmark Hall of Fame, one of television's most awarded television series and longest running, this Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time on the Hallmark Channel. We have Dan Rigatell, one of the executive producers of this film, directed by Roger Spotswood, starring Andy McDowell and a great cast, too. We'll talk more about them shortly. And Dan is with us live from Los Angeles this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tom and Apple Valley will be live from the other side of the U.S. of A., namely Newark, where it is 67 degrees at the top of the hour. If you have a question or a comment for Dan, don't be shy. Make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. We hope on Friday's episode, our next one, to have the creators of Hollywood Darlings. That's the pop comedy that premiered last summer to good reviews, became one of the sleeper shows of 2017, just came back last week for its second season. That's Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Talk about what it's like to work with Andy, especially since you've had a terrific relationship with her, with Hallmark, throughout the years.
You know, Andy is extremely serious about her work. And I don't know if you know, but she has some more films that have just come out. One is a New York Times Critics, you know, Critics Choice pick. I mean, she's been constantly working and believes very strongly in what she does. And as long as, you know, she wants, takes it all very seriously, she needs the time to, I mean, it's not just about learning the lines, but it's about the character and deciding who this character is and what she's really all about. And while she is both very elegant and beautiful, she also is someone who looks at what is underneath all of that. And that's what makes a difference. So, for example, you know, here she is at on her 60th birthday or just before her 60th birthday playing a woman who is quite striking. And then she discovers that she is dying of cancer. I mean, I'm sorry to put that out there, but that's literally what happens is for the character. And so ultimately, you know, everything from makeup to wardrobe to her physical appearance starts going downhill. Maybe downhill is the wrong way to put it, but starts becoming more realistic. So we see a scene of her, you know, walking upstairs at her beach house where she can barely get up the stairs and starts tripping. We see her, you know, eyes blinking a lot because she's so into this character. And she will do whatever she can to make something work, which is, say, the polar opposite of her being, not the polar opposite, but totally different from her being a judge in, you know, in the Cedar Cove series. I mean, here she's a housewife who's been left. She's a widow. Her husband has left her. He was not the nicest guy in the world. And she has developed her own sense of independence, and Andy very much plays into that. She just figures all that out, and that's what's so impressive. So it's not as though she spends, you know, oh, let's just do the scene. I mean, she'll think it through and discuss it and understand what it means to be someone at that age and that mental, physical condition, and then she'll play it. And that's what's so great about it. One of the many things that's great about it. Also, she likes good food, which I do too. So between us both, you know, when we're down south, we can have a little bit of barbecue. And
back in December, Dan, back in December, we had Dave, the acclaimed author David Baldacci on our show, who had done The Christmas Train, which was adapted by Hallmark Hall of Fame. And in the
No, I haven't seen that, so I can't really comment on it, but go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you that when we had David on the program to talk about that film, he was really pleased that that he was able to have some role in the film. He didn't have a big role in terms of making the film, but he trusted Hallmark. He trusted the producers, the directors, everyone involved, and he was very pleased with the way it came out. In this case, with The Beach House, you have the writer, you have the author of the best-selling book, Mary Alice Monroe, involved as an executive producer. What was it like to work with her on a day-to-day level in bringing her story to life?
Well, again, her connection was principally with Andy. That's where it started, and Andy was the one who knew her. But she was so enthusiastic throughout the entire process. I mean, she came down in the early stages, and then she came down towards the end. And, you know, we would just consult with her about whatever we were doing, and she was a great, great supporter of the whole film. Everything from cast to the details to trying to get the turtles right. And by the way, getting turtles, you know, and we had some model turtles out there also on the beach. You know, that's challenging. That doesn't happen automatically. So, and thanks to the Georgia Department of Natural Resources, I may have the name wrong, I'm sorry, but they actually had someone come down who's the head of that and actually was digging with his hands on his body the print marks of turtles as they crawl up on the beach. So Mary Alice Monroe was all part of that, and I think she was totally enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the experience of being with her, and I believe she's as happy with the film as we are. So we were involved in every step. Andy and I every day, Mary Alice Monroe when she could be there, and it was a nonstop time down in a place called Tybee Island in Savannah where we did all the filming, and we got very lucky. No hurricanes, post-hurricane season, although there had been a little bit of flooding in, you know, some of our locations before we got there, so we had to, you know, be careful with that, but we were very fortunate in every way, I would say.
Yeah. You sort of anticipated what I was going to ask next, which was where do you shoot the movie, film the film? And also, when you deal with a main plot line like the preservation of nature, one of the things that a lot of documentary producers who deal with the world of natural nature know that, you know, you have to wait for nature. Nature doesn't wait for you. You know, it's like you got to be ready. It's the toughest thing to direct in many respects because, unlike human beings, you can't tell them, go here, go there, you know, and now we're going to shoot you, and now we're going to film you. It's like Mother Nature,
right.
Father Nature, whenever they want to do their thing, they do their thing. So it was very, in many ways, it was very fortunate that Roger had that background of doing an animal film. But I'm curious how you and the other executive producers and Andy and the cast had to deal with that, you know, that philosophy of dealing with nature when nature happens.
Well, I hesitate to say this, but I will say we got a great model builder because it's rare to find a mother loggerhead turtle on a beach, and we couldn't wait for, you know, 6 months to find one and have that one interact with the cast. So we had a model builder build one, and that process is very time consuming because you want to make it as accurate as possible. And then we, you know, the movement of the turtle had to be accurate also. So that was something we were very focused on. I mean, we literally, unlike, say, Roger's film about polar bears, where they had a baby polar bear and literally worked with it and kind of met the challenges that you were just describing, our challenges were making everything as realistic as possible in the amount of time that we had. If we had a whole year to make the film, we might have gotten lucky. Or we might have gone to Australia, where there are turtles that actually, you know, one finds more often. But this is very much a southern story set in South Carolina, shot in Georgia, and it's about, you know, preserving turtles and doing everything possible to preserve them. And so we had a little bit of Hollywood magic there helping us out.
How about the other people in the cast? Minka Kelly, Chan Michael Murray, Mackenzie Vega, if you know her from The Good Wife. What was it like dealing with them as well as Andy?
You know, it's really interesting because I didn't know what to expect of Minka Kelly because I knew Minka from, oh, her most, one of her most famous things, Friday Night Lights. And, you know, in which she was much younger and a cheerleader and a, all of that. But here she played a daughter who left home when she was, call it 18 or 19, to go off to Chicago to college. And then basically doesn't return because she did not want to have to deal with a kind of domineering father and a mother who played second fiddle to the father. And she comes back. And she really understood the nature of what that was. And she brought that to me in a wonderful way to life. And then ultimately realizes that she needs to be with her mother and takes up with her in every possible way, where at first, you know, it's a little more confrontational. Mom, I didn't, you know, you never stood up to him when he was mean and all of that. Well, that changes totally when she discovers that she's sick, and they redevelop a relationship that they literally never had. And to me, that's one of the most moving parts of the story, is that a mother-daughter reconnect when called the daughter, I don't know, 30-something, and the mother-something, and life has gone on, and they love each other. But that had been missing for 12 or 14 years. And then to add to the complication, there's the brother who, you know, was not someone who really either stood up to his father or kind of took over in a way, I don't want to be stereotyping here, but an old-fashioned Southern style of the brother being more important than the sister. And that all plays out, I think, in such an interesting way, where they realize their roles and their humanity. And it's all connected, yes, to turtles, as you say, but it's also a human connection primarily. And that's where I think the story really excels. But I'm not terribly objective, so you'll have to forgive me for some of what I'm saying, because I'm a fan of it. And I'm not a fan of everything I do, but this is one that I am. And I can't thank Andy enough for having trusted me and brought it to me in the first place. And, of course, Hallmark for having decided to make it and broadcast it.
Dan, one of the very best Hallmark Hall of Fame presentations, and I can't, it's amazing to think that it happened over 30 years ago, was a story also about connection. It was called Promise, that featured James Woods and James Garner playing brothers. Woods was a schizophrenic, and it was all about having to be reconnected in a way that initially Garner's character did not like, where he sort of had to play father to his own brother. And then it ended in a very sort of melancholy, semi-sad, semi-hopeful way where he realized he couldn't do that. And they both had to live their lives but still have a connection. And it seems from what you've been talking about a lot this half hour is that there's a similar promise-like quality to this film in dealing with people connecting and reconnecting in the face of a personal tragedy or personal affliction.
Absolutely. I wish, I don't know the film. I wish I had seen it, but there's so many Hallmark Hall of Fame films over the years, although recently it's not, you know, been very much alive. But I think this is, and I'll just be selfish here and talk for ourselves, that this is a comeback, I think, for Hall of Fame, and doing a story that has, you know, real emotion to it, and not one of my, you know, lovely Debbie McCumber, you know, Christmas movies where, yes, there's sadness in those, but it's basically happy and positive and all of that. This has more depth to it, and I think that's what's so interesting, is that Hallmark was willing to give us all this opportunity in which, you know, our principal character dies during the course of the film. Maybe I'm telling you too much, but it is something that I think is different and very important. And the reconnection of family is so unusual. And that's what I think people will either love or maybe not. You can't, you know, there's no way to tell in advance. And that's what attracted Roger to it and, you know, Andy and I, and that's why we did it.
The Beach House, based on the New York Times best-selling book by Mary Alice Monroe, who serves as one of the executive producers. It will premiere as the latest presentation of the Hallmark Hall of Fame this Saturday night, April 28th, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time on the Hallmark Channel. Andy McDowell leads the cast, directed by Roger Spotswood. Check your local news where Hallmark Channel appears in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the program online, here's where you go, www.hallmarkchannel.com. It's www.hallmarkchannel.com. Once again, it's The Beach House this Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, the latest presentation of the Hallmark Hall of Fame. Dan Rigoteau, one of the executive producers of the program, thank you very much for coming in. Good luck with the program Saturday night. I have a hunch it's going to be a very, very big winner and another great example of the tremendous, tremendous talent and the tremendous run of what is one of the really great television series and ongoing television presences of all time.
Well, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak, and I hope you were right. I hope that people connect to it the way we hope that we plan for them to. And best of luck.
Thank you. I'm sure they will. Dan, all the greatest to you and the cast and crew. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Dan Rigoteau, executive producer of The Beach House, this Saturday night on Hallmark Channel and from the Hallmark Hall of Fame, joining us live from Los Angeles. Before we go, a quick up as an update where we catch up with some of the guests and topics we had in this program. A week ago, among our guests, we had Terry Kopp, the former Law & Order writer, producer, who was putting together In Contempt, which premiered 2 weeks ago on BET. The next episode, by the way, is this coming Tuesday night at 10 p.m. In the course of our interview, she mentioned that In Contempt, which deals with the legal aid system in New York, was not shot in New York. It was shot in Toronto. Why? Expense. And maybe one of the reasons why also was that the show could not get a diversity tax credit. That was the plan that was passed by the state legislature, but vetoed ultimately last year by none other than Governor Andrew Cuomo. Why? For reasons that were very much a mystery. Well, this past Thursday, I went to Winston Baker's Content Capital Summit here in New York. Julie Menon, the commissioner of the Mayor's Office of Media Entertainment, was there. I brought up the subject of the diversity tax credit and In Contempt as well. And two things. First of all, there is a sense that there's going to be another effort this year to try to get that bill finally passed, where if you're a television program and you're produced in New York with diversity both in front and behind the camera, you can get a tax credit, also marketing credit as well. And secondly, maybe just maybe if BET does renew the show for a second season, that Menon's crew will definitely get on the horn to try to encourage BET to produce the show in New York, where I definitely think it belongs. We'll push out Terry Kopp, by the way, on the program. You can catch that interview at our homepage, loxofree.com/televised. Remember, we're back at our regular time Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. In the meantime, check out our podcast version. Check out loxofree.com/televised. Find me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you because what you say matters. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not through those of Blog Talk Radio or iHeartRadio. Our production associate, BTR, is Candace Williams. Eddie Toth, BTR General Manager, and the co-founders of this very enterprise, Alan Levy and Bob Charish. Tomorrow Be Televised is brought to you today by Audible.com, proud development partner of the New York Television Festival and an Amazon company. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. For Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your week. Back Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where. Blog Talk Radio and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to today and the rest of the week, please make it safe and great. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.